This past weekend, we attended the Boston University Conference on Narrative Writing. Journalists and historians, including presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin, speaking to packed audiences about their craft. Her book on Lincoln, Team of Rivals, became the film by Steven Spielberg. Another on Eleanor and Franklin Delano Roosevelt won the Pulitzer. Her look at Lyndon Johnson had its start when she was Johnson's White House intern. We spoke before our keynote conversation about the fledgling Trump presidency. The Republican healthcare bill was supposed to be a triumphant victory, but leaders dashed to and fro trying to get votes, and it was ultimately pulled for lack of them.
Well, I think there's no question that it's a huge problem that's been created for this young presidency of President Trump. The whole idea when a person becomes president is, what are your priorities? And I remember Tip O'Neill said something, you got to dance with the person who you brought to the dance.
It's the Speaker of the House.
Yes, the Speaker of the House. And what I would have assumed would have been the first priority of business would have been infrastructure and possibly tax cut. The infrastructure could have gotten the Democrats aboard. Tax cut might have been a bargaining thing, which is what the Republicans really wanted. But by going for this crazy, difficult, complicated problem first without knowing you had your own party behind you, I think it's just going to cast a shadow on everything else.
Can you think of another time in history where there was this type of event?
Not really, because I think we've never had in history before a president who had absolutely no political experience or military experience. So that it worked during the campaign because he ran a brilliant campaign in some ways, reaching out to people who felt left behind by the Democratic Party. But then the difference between campaigning and governing is so huge. And the fact that President Trump didn't stop doing his tweets, which allowed him during the campaign to get a lot of coverage, and he loved them. But then the negative tweets, I think, just took and sucked up the news. Even in these last weeks, we were talking much more about wiretapping in Russia than that very health care bill that should have been the priority of all the messaging for the last few weeks.
What about what's happening within the Republican Party? The fact that what happened, even though the president blamed it on Democrats not coming aboard, the fact that you have one arm of the party that's fiscally conservative, doesn't want to spend anymore, you have the moderates in the party who are afraid of cutting out health care, and a president who thought he could arm twist both. Is there any example in history?
Well, when you think about even during President Obama's presidency, that part of the Republican Party proved impossible for anybody to work with. It's almost as if they're against governing, not just on conservative principles, and would rather lose a fight rather than compromise in any degree to get a possible bill rather than a perfect bill.
Well, of course, they're saying the same thing now about the Democrats.
Well, there's no way they could have imagined that the Democrats were going to vote to repeal Obamacare, the signature achievement of their president and their time in office. When they passed that bill, they really felt they had done something, rightly or wrongly, with some of the provisions of the bill that their children would be talking about, or their grandchildren years to come, like Medicare or like Social Security. I'm sure that there have been times in history that have been worse than this. In fact, I was on a plane the other day and I was telling a woman that who was so concerned about the whole anxiety and fear today. And I said, oh, look, it was much worse in the 1850s. I mean, the obstructionism of the people in the South versus what was going on in the North. And they brought guns into the Senate chamber and the guy from the South hit the Massachusetts senator over the head with a cane. And she said, yeah, but that ended up in a civil war with 600,000 dead. So I said, oh, I better think of a better example.
Well, can't you go forward to the 1890s? We just read Stephen Kinzer's book, and there was a huge battle over whether or not the U.S. would seize the Philippines or other countries. And there was the same kind of fist fighting in Congress.
Now, I think the 1890s actually are the best parallel for what's happening now, not simply because of imperialism and what was happening abroad, but rather, the Industrial Revolution had created much of the same emotional anxieties that technological revolution and globalization have created today. People were moving from farms to cities. There was a lot of inventions going on, the telephone, the telegraph. A lot of people felt life was speeding up in ways they didn't know. There was tons of immigration coming in from abroad. And it was a time of demagoguery and populism. But luckily for the country, much of that energy got channeled through Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, and the progressive movement into moderate, rational reform that took care of some of the problems of the industrial area, factory exploitation, women and children working too many hours, maximum hours, and railroad regulation and food and drug regulation, so that there was a sense that the problems were being addressed, even though a lot of anger was still out there.
Well, you mentioned Teddy Roosevelt. He came off as kind of almost buffoonish a bit. You know, I want to go kill someone in Cuba. I've never killed anybody, you know, and a warmonger and kind of reckless. and a self-aggrandizing. You know, he was great at having pictures taken of himself marching up hills and such. And yet, as you say, he's the one who channeled some of that populist energy into good causes.
Well, there were two Teddy Roosevelts. There was the one who was in many ways a warmonger, who had this ridiculous concept that the victories of peace were never as good as the victories of war. And yet on the domestic front, he was very, very savvy, and he understood what needed to be done economically. And most importantly, and unlike President Trump, he had a great relationship with the members of the press. They became his partners. The investigative reporters at that time who unearthed all the problems that we were having in Standard Oil, in the railroad industry, in food and drug, they would write these 10,000-word pieces that people would gobble up, and that would force then the Republicans in the Congress who didn't want to have regulation to have it because the country was mobilized. And Teddy understood that if he was going to have a relationship with the press, he had to be able to have a relationship where they would criticize him. I mean, there's this great story where at one point a great journalist wrote a review of his book about the Spanish-American War, and he said Teddy was so, you know, not buffoonerish, but so much in love with himself that he put himself in every single instance, every battle of the war. And he should have called the book Alone in Cuba. And so what does Teddy do? Everyone around the country is laughing because this guy's a famous journalist. And he writes him back. He says, I regret to tell you that my wife and my best friends absolutely love your review of my book. Now you owe me something. You have to come meet me. I've always wanted to meet you. And they became friends. He continued to criticize him. Teddy would criticize him back. But they had this strong relationship, as he did with most members of the press. That's really different from what we're seeing today.
What about the relationship with Paul Ryan? Paul Ryan went from the Capitol up to the Oval Office to, according to reports, beg the president to pull the bill because he didn't have the votes.
Well, I think on the opposite side, what you're looking for is a president who, with a majority leader and the leader of the Senate, has such a close relationship that they are working together in tandem and not blaming one another when something goes wrong. That's the last thing you can do. I mean, part of that story you're talking about, I understand, is that originally President Trump wanted to have the bill actually put on the floor so that people had to say no, and then revenge could be taken, and that Paul Ryan persuaded him, I'm very glad that he did, not to do that. I mean, that's not going to help anyone to have revenge out there. I mean, that's been part of what's plagued our politics for the last two decades.
Is there another time when it was a plague, revenge, somebody wanting revenge rather than what's best for the country?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a natural human reaction. But then the greatest leaders are the ones who, like Lincoln, was able to say, if I let resentments fester, they will poison a part of me. I mean, that's what Lyndon Johnson understood when he became such a great leader of the Congress, that, of course, there were people he was angry with over the years. There were people who weren't going with him on bills even then, and he could do it in private, but he wouldn't do it in public in the same way.
What about the staying with Lincoln, the team of rivals? Some thought that maybe Trump was putting together a team of rivals in his cabinet, bringing in even former rivals on the campaign trail. You've got Rick Perry from Texas and Ben Carson.
I think the one encouraging thing was that President Trump was willing to surround himself with people in the cabinet who criticized him during the hearings, especially the foreign policy people, Tillerson and Mattis. They didn't agree with him on a lot of things, the nuclear deal with Iran, climate change. And instead of getting angry with them, which he might have if they had criticized him personally, he simply had a blanket tweet. And he said, my guys are doing great up there. I want them to question me and argue with me. So that part has seemed interesting.
Although you have Tillerson traveling without any press and threatening not to go to the NATO meeting. Now he may be going, but yeah, I hear your point.
Well, I have no doubt that unless a better relationship is developed between the press and the president, then we've got a real problem in a democracy. The Fourth Estate is needed. They need him. He needs them. And sure, there have been controversial times between all the presidents when they get mad at the press and they'll close down a particular reporter or they might shut the television down. But in the end, the best presidents have worked out a working relationship where they will criticize the press will criticize them, and they'll go about their business, both of them. They're both professionals.
We're here for this conference, The Power of Narrative, Storytelling. You are a narrative historian. Have you thought about how you'd write the narrative of the Trump presidency? It is so young, but have you been thinking, turning that over in your head?
I think the biggest question still will be, can the man who campaigned, and we must say campaigned effectively, and tweeted in the middle of the night things that somehow didn't turn off his supporters during the day, can that man realize that once in office, words matter? And I keep arguing that just like Lincoln had hot letters that he would write to people when he was angry with them, and then he would put them aside and never send them, hoping he would cool down and never need to show his anger. That President Trump should have a fake Twitter account. When he's happy, he can talk to everybody. When he's mad, it doesn't go anywhere. Because you can't allow those negative emotions, I think, to rule and change the agenda of the day. A president's greatest power, in some ways, is to set the agenda. And too often, these tweets have set the agenda for him. And maybe not even his meaning to, but because he couldn't control back the anger that he felt.
Yeah. Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you.
You are very welcome.
That's Doris. Before our conversation at Boston University's conference this past weekend, The Power of Narrative, Telling True Stories in Turbulent Times, in our conversation, she talked about how President Obama convened a roundtable of historians to help him make decisions about present-day problems. Well, should that roundtable be renewed? One attendee this weekend suggested that it should be required that presidents meet with historians. Your thoughts. Welcome at hereandnow.org.